This is an interview with Richard Roberts for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive of the History of Financial Regulation. I'm William Thomas. The date is May 15th, 2014, and we're in Washington, D.C. So thanks for agreeing to speak with us today. The focus of our interview will be on municipal securities and your time at the Commission, but really it's an oral history of your life. So why don't we start with a little bit of your personal background? I guess you are from Alabama?
I'm originally from Alabama. I went to Auburn University, went to engineering school, decided I didn't want to be an engineer, went to law school at the University of Alabama, then practiced briefly in Tuscaloosa, where the law school was located. I worked in a very small practice law firm with a private practitioner who was in the Alabama State Senate at the time. He wanted to run for Congress. He did run for Congress in 1979. And won, and I moved up here with him then the first time. And I worked for him as chief of staff. His name was Richard Shelby. He's in the Senate now. Worked for him for two terms, moved back to Alabama, worked for several law firms, mostly small law firms. Did some municipal securities law at that point in time, probably more tax than disclosure related, but I did learn a little bit about the municipal securities disclosure at that time, or lack thereof. And again, this was in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. And then when Congressman Shelby was elected to the Senate, I moved back up in 87 and served as his chief of staff when he was first in the Senate. I left early in 90 just for a brief period of time. I worked for a law firm in town, and then I was appointed to the SEC at some point in time in 1990 and served. The term had already started, but I served 5 years, served a few months past my term, almost 5 years, left in August or end of August in 95. Worked for a consulting firm for a few years, then worked for a law firm for the same firm for almost 10, and then started my own consulting firm around 2006, and I've been there ever since.
All right. So when you were working for then-Representative Shelby, he was on the House Energy and Commerce Committee?
Well, it started out actually as the Interstate and Foreign Commerce Committee, and the name changed to the Energy and Commerce Committee, I think in 1980, in our second term, 81.
Okay. Could you tell me a little bit about the activities there?
It was very interesting. It was my first exposure to the SEC. We had over there. It's now morphed into the House Financial Services Committee. But at that point in time, banking and securities and other things were separate. And we had Securities Exchange Commission oversight. First, Harley Staggers was the chairman. John Dingell was the subcommittee chairman. And then he was the chairman. He was one of Senator Shelby's mentors. Mm-hmm. And Chairman Dingell, as we all know, was very interested in the SEC. Tough on them, but protective of them, too, and definitely supported full funding of the agency, tough enforcement, being fair and reasonable and balanced, but aggressive, tough enforcement in keeping with the agency's history. And was also pretty tough on them on the rulemaking side, especially in terms of their priorities. So he had this, Chairman Dingell had this mixture of balance of being protective and tough at the same time. And I learned quite a bit about the SEC. And it was a good positive perspective to learn from someone who was really interested in the well-being of the agency, but held them accountable.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the big issues at that time?
Well, funding, of course, was an issue. I think you had a number of things about what the direction of the enforcement program was going to be. You know, at that point in time, the commission had focused. Chairman Dingell was encouraging, it's very interesting, this was, again, in the early 80s, was encouraging the commission to be bolder and more aggressive in areas other than insider trading. And ultimately, when I was there, I could see the SEC doing that, the commission doing that. So that was very interesting from an enforcement perspective. He was very supportive of the funding of it. I think that he was disappointed. He was pleased with some rulemaking projects, disappointed with others. I think he was and it wasn't all the commission's fault pertinent to this interview. He was disappointed that the commission was not more active in the municipal securities area, even as early as the early 80s.
Mm-hmm. Of course, at that time, the MSRB had been created, so
yes,
there had been some action in that area, but there wasn't the disclosure regime that we'd see a little bit later on.
My memory, I don't exactly know when the whoops problem happened in Seattle.
That was right around then, 82.
Yeah, I think that was the trigger for him.
Yeah.
That was kind of what I thought, but I may have had my timing mixed up. But that had an impact on Chairman Dingell, and he made his views, as he always did, he made his views with... forcefully with the SEC. So that's certainly one of them. There are others as well.
Was there a politics surrounding the SEC at the time? Of course, Richard Shelby was a Democrat, but a Southern Democrat.
Not really. You didn't have the politics around the commission that you do today, or even when I was at the commission. And it was certainly less politicized when I was there than it is now. For the most part, everyone in the agency was sort of pulling in one direction, and they were treated very favorably by members of the House and the Senate on both sides of the aisle.
And did you yourself develop a particular interest in securities at this time, or were you mainly?
Because of John Dingell's interest. I'm glad you brought that up. One of my motivators was Chairman Dingell's interest in municipal securities. And when I left Congressman Shelby after two terms, that was one of the areas I went to work with. We represented, we were involved in a number of housing finance matters at some of the firms I worked with. Local housing authorities issued bonds. We represented issuers.
Was this in Alabama again?
Yes, it was in Alabama. And we also, underwriters counsel on some things, but mostly issuers counsel.
Mm-hmm.
It probably did more work in the multifamily housing area than any others. We represented, at one point in time, one of the firms I worked with, we represented the Housing Finance Authority. So, and they were always, at that point in time, again, this was from 83 to 87, mm-hmm. they were, not all that period of time, but some of that time, 83 to 86. It was a big multifamily housing push. And so there was constant bond issues.
And the 86 Tax Reform Act came along during that
and
time.
And that drove a lot of that because folks wanted to get in before that became effective because it took away a lot of the tax incentives in that space. You're absolutely right.
Do you have a chance to see its effect on the law? I know you mentioned that you had worked quite a bit on the tax issues of securities.
At that point in time, in 86 was when the act happened. I followed it, but by the time I was about out the door then. Mm-hmm. Senator Shelby was running for election, he was running for the Senate at that point. So I was kind of in between. But that act, which I don't remember much of now, really had a lot of changes. I guess that was probably, wasn't the last tax act, but probably the last big tax act. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's pretty common. There was one, I guess, in President Bush's, the first President Bush's regime, but nothing as comprehensive as that.
Okay. So I gather that you'd maintained quite a bit of contact then with Richard Shelby, and did he ask you back then when he became senator?
He asked me to come and work for him as chief of staff, and I was very fortunate that he asked me, and that I was able to do that.
Okay. So tell me a little bit about that experience of moving over to the Senate.
Well, he was on banking. He was a freshman member, of course, and still a Democrat at the time. Very active, and I can't speak for Senator Shelby, but I can give you my impression of his views. His views were in large part formed by Chairman Dingell. He was largely supportive of the SEC funding, not maybe as much as Chairman Dingell, but largely supportive, even today. He believed he wanted them to hit the right note in terms of enforcement. And by that, he wanted them to sort of balance those competing objectives of being tough and aggressive and fair and reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
And he expected them to enforce the rules that they adopted, and if they weren't, to change those rules. He was, even more so than Chairman Dingell, a little more disappointed on the rulemaking side. Mm-hmm. He didn't feel like, at least early in his career, that they spent as much time on cost-benefit analysis. Certainly that's changed today. And he just didn't feel like that in some instances, I don't know if I can think of specific examples, that they were quite as rigorous on the rulemaking front. He also supported enforcement, not continuing to focus on insider trading, mm-hmm. but to broaden their scope.
Well, of course, that's the big issue at the time, too, is the insider trading cases.
Oh, yeah. And the commission has mm-hmm. always done a great job in insider trading. But you're right. That was really a little later.
Okay.
That was because you had some of that beginning to happen, the Milken and the bond scandals, the junk bond scandals. You also had savings and loan scandals at the same time. Mm-hmm. So that drove a lot of activity. I think, I can't speak for Senator Shelby, I think he was pretty pleased with what the SEC did in the enforcement context mm-hmm. with respect to those instances. And I haven't heard too much complaint about that. So in many respects, he mirrored what his mentor, Chairman Dingell, mm-hmm. views were with respect to the SEC, maybe a little more pronounced in some areas.
Okay. And, of course, there was the 87 market break, too. Did that have a big impact?
You had the 87 break, but you had smaller ones in, like, 89, 92, 91, 92. You had a series of ones thereafter. And certainly that had an impact on him because I think he wanted to know, you can't hold the SEC responsible for what necessarily happens in the marketplace, but it does cause you to re-examine their regulatory structure mm-hmm. in this space. Again, I believe that he was of the view they were doing a good job in the enforcement context. Maybe they weren't quite as, it's very difficult to do so, maybe weren't quite as prospective in terms of their rulemaking, or did not quite look as far ahead as he thought they should. Mm-hmm.
One of your first speeches as commissioner was on the 1990 Market Reform Act, I think.
Yes, and it was very good. I had some mixed emotions about it, but I thought it was very. And again, that's mm-hmm. a pretty good instance where most members of Congress were supportive of that. I mean, it was not viewed by the partisan lens that SEC legislation may be today. Mm-hmm.
Could you give me just an outline of your activities as chief of staff? What did that entail kind of on a day-to-day basis?
Well, we had about 30 folks, probably maybe a little bit more than that if you count it on the staff. And it's just to meet with people to try and make sure the senator was prepared for. He was on Armed Services and Senate Banking and I think Aging, too, Select Committee on Aging at the time when I was there. He ultimately went to appropriations, but he was on Armed Services when I was there. So to make sure he was prepared for his meetings, more importantly, to try to be responsive to constituents, mm-hmm. because, again, he was just elected, and your first term, he was not going to run Washington. He's had an experience as a first-term congressman, so he sort of understood that. Mm-hmm. He knew that he was not going to run the place, and he knew that his views once in a while may have some impact, but they weren't going to have the impact that the senior members were. And he tried to contribute where he could, but he didn't necessarily get heavily involved in anything. He tried to pick his spots, because that's what you have to do when you're a freshman, a new member. So he focused more on the state, really, than he did in Washington to make sure his position was secure. He was responsive. And again, he'd come from a 7-county district to, I think, a 63-county state. Mm-hmm. Even though there's only a few population centers, it's a pretty wide span of territory. So he spent a lot of time in all these different counties. Of course, he did that in campaign, but he certainly did it after he was elected. So when I was there, again, in the first half of his first term, it was more Alabama-focused.
Okay. Can I ask you just a little bit about, he would have been a Southern Democrat, basically in the mold of those who had been left over from the prior era of the Southern Democrat. Is that correct, or did he have...
No, that is correct. Okay. He was a Southern Democrat, a conservative, but everyone was a Democrat, but it was changing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The landscape was changing at that point in time, and again, I can't speak for Senator Shelby, but he had thought about changing parties as early as when he was in the House. Right. And I think as part of the Reagan Revolution, One of the members of the who came in with him as a freshman congressman was Phil Graham. They were very good friends. And, of course, Senator Graham had a very conservative, pro-economic capitalist philosophy that Senator Shelby agreed with in large part. He was probably more of a populist than Phil was. But that had a lot of influence over him. And he could see how the South was beginning to change, that for whatever reason, the centrist Democrats were becoming fewer and fewer. Phil Graham started as a Democrat and switched parties, I think in the 80s, actually.
Yeah, I mean, they were both some of the later people to switch over, I think.
Yes,
yeah.
They were. Well, I think Graham may have been one of the first, actually.
Okay. Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Because I think he did it in the House side. I think so. And then he ran for the Senate. So I think he did it 10 years earlier than Senator Shelby did. So, and Alabama, of course, is a southern state. It moves at a little slower pace, and so things unfold there a little slower than they do in Texas, I'd say. But the same political dynamic that was taking place in Texas was taking place in Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Georgia, South Carolina, Tennessee, And I don't know that he necessarily changed his views a lot, although as you get older, you tend to become more conservative in a lot of instances. I think that's been true with him. I think he was of the view that he always thought he was sort of in the center, and I think his view was the center moved on him. I don't know if that's true today, but I think that was true when he switched parties, my opinion again. So that was an interesting change. Now, again, when that change occurred, I was not working for him. I was at the SEC.
Right. Tell me a little bit about how your nomination came about.
I expressed an interest in the SEC. I learned quite a bit, at least in a cosmetic macro sense, hopefully more macro than cosmetic, from Chairman Dingell, working on the legislative front. I had the opportunity to work in the space a little bit, not much, more so in municipal securities than others. In the 80s for a brief period of time. So I had an interest in it. I talked to folks in the agency. They were very proud that they worked there, enjoyed it very much. It had probably one of the highest approvals from a federal government job survey standpoint at the time. Everyone was comfortable with the mission. It was well received on Congress by both sides of the aisle. It had a very positive history. So I thought that I was interested in it. I knew a little bit about it, and it was attractive to me. I was still interested in government at that point in time. And I thought that I was a long shot candidate, but I was interested in the position.
It's fairly common, certainly then, I think, for people from Senate staff to go over into there.
More so today, but so even today. Then you had a few folks from the Hill going to work at different agencies, mm-hmm. not just the commission, but different agencies.
Okay. So tell me a little bit about the commission then. Richard Breeden was in as chairman.
He was chairman. And again, the commission is nonpartisan, so right. I was a Democrat. President Bush was the first President Bush, 41, was president at the time, and Senator Shelby was a Democrat, but he was a conservative Democrat, and they were looking to put a conservative Democrat on the commission, so the stars were aligned for me.
Right, he replaced Grunfest, too.
Yeah, Commissioner Grunfest,
who
was irreplaceable, of course, but so the politics, if the place, the agency is not immune from politics, mm-hmm. And that's the interesting part about why I like, one of the reasons I think so highly of the commission is I like the setup. Other agencies have it too. You have five members. You have that nonpartisan makeup. It gives you a really good balance and a broader perspective. And you just don't have folks just ramming through sort of a single kind of interest, one issue that sort of lean to one side or the other. It's usually a little more balanced than mm-hmm. that.
And could you tell me a little bit, first of all, the commission at that time was actually fairly youthful. You were less than 40. Breeden, I think, had just turned 40.
Yeah.
Mary Shapiro was even younger.
Mary was already there. She was younger than I was. Ed Fleischman was a little older. And Phil Lochner was there at the time. He was a little older, but not, but still youthful, not much. And so, yes, it was younger. And Chairman Braden, I think, was an excellent chairman. Hard, driving guy. I didn't necessarily agree with everything that he was for, because I didn't necessarily agree with everything I was for either, especially over the passage of time. But I had the opportunity to serve under, I'm not saying they're the greatest chairmen, but I thought they were both very good chairmen. Hmm. And both Richard Braden and Arthur Levitt, it was an honor and privilege to serve on their commissions. I think they did an excellent job. They were a little different, but they weren't as different in terms of, they're certainly different in terms of personality and management style and things of that nature.
Can you tell me a little bit about those differences?
Well, I mean, Richard was younger, youthful, more energetic, in some respects more emotional. Chairman Levitt was later in his career, calm, sedate, more patient, you know, not as prone to youthful initiatives. You know, he wasn't interested in moving as fast. He wanted to be more careful, and whereas Richard just wanted to get it moving.
Mm-hmm.
But having said that, the substantive output of the two commissions wasn't much different. Thematically, it was still the same, you know, while the mission changed at some point in time around then. But when I first came in, it was just protect investors, and it later became a protection of investors and then capital efficiency, the capital formation process. I don't exactly know when that happened. I think it happened when I was there, but I may be wrong about that. Do you recall, Will?
I don't know a precise moment of turnover. I know that Breeden was very interested in.
Yeah, he was interested. I don't know that it happened until after I left. I don't know if it was part of the securities market improvement, the Securities Litigation Reform Act, or the NISMIA, you know, that happened thereafter. I was there for, anyway, I'm not sure about that, but that transition was beginning to take place. And it had more impact later. It didn't have much impact right away. Like anything, it takes a while. I think it has much more impact today, that change, than it did then. Because at that point in time, folks were not litigating quite as much against the SEC as they did. That theory hadn't developed like it had today. But I think from a rulemaking perspective, both chairmen were very tough on enforcement. I mean, very tough on not only making sure we were bringing enforcement actions the right action, but they were tough on the enforcement staff, too. I mean, they wanted them to dot their I's and cross their T's. And in those closed meetings, both Chairman Breeden and Chairman Levitt, you know, they'd be tough on them with respect to their cases. They believe that the SEC and I do, too, at its heart, is an enforcement agency, and that the public opinion of the SEC will rise and fall on the back of its enforcement actions. It's not the only thing they do, but from a public perception standpoint, they believed it was the most important. I think that's pretty clear today because of the enforcement misses that have occurred have really negatively impacted the commission. So enforcement, almost the same. And they wanted to bring they wanted a broader reach too, not just insider trading cases, cases against banks and securities, against, you know, public securities companies, just a broader array of enforcement actions. And Chairman Breeden really started that, the focus on private company, especially financial institution enforcement activity, which you see all the time today. On the rulemaking aside, it was pretty much the same as well. Definitely Chairman Breeden had more in terms of number because he's very active. He always wanted to do something. In some respects, Chairman Levitt probably had bigger initiatives, you know. The order handling rules, for example, after I left, which started. I mean, he really changed the market structure probably more than any chairman in modern history.
Okay. So could you tell me a little bit more about the rules that were on
Reeden's? I was afraid you would ask me that because the memory gets a little dim.
Were they disclosure-oriented mainly?
Chairman Breeden was very disclosure-oriented in some reason. He I don't know if it was the He probably brought the first set of comprehensive executive compensation disclosure rules, a very controversial. Chairman Breeden also, for a Republican, you wouldn't think this was also a real strong protector of shareholder rights. Mm-hmm. He believed in shareholder democracy.
Right.
You know, the one share, one vote concept. We had, you know, executive
proxy reform.
Proxy reform. We had executive compensation disclosure rules, very controversial with respect to the corporate America. Chairman Breeden told me that he never saw as many corporate executives as he did when they were involved in the executive compensation disclosure rules. So clearly he hit a nerve with those. Proxy reform, Section 16 reform, executive compensation, those are things that came to mind. He also did some things in the municipal securities area, mm-hmm. you know, amendments to Rule 15C212, also was involved in interpretive release at the time. So he was very active on the rulemaking front. Those are some of the things I remember. Is there anything you wanted to refresh my recollection on?
Nothing in particular, I think. I know that derivatives and that sort of thing are becoming more and more prominent at this time.
Chairman Breeden's commission brought the first enforcement case in the derivatives area, probably more of a sales practice case, mm-hmm. but it involved derivatives. You had Procter & Gamble was involved in sort of a derivatives problem. Also, you had what was the investment firm they were subject to? Investment firm was taken over. Anyway, he brought a couple of derivatives related cases. Were the first ones that I'd ever noted. They weren't the kind of cases you see today because mm-hmm. they had sort of a sales practice focus on them. It's almost like retail. Chairman Breeden also brought the prudential securities enforcement case, which is a big deal. He also wrapped up most of the Milken and those kind of Drexel Burnham cases.
And I think it may have cooled down by the time that you got there, but I think that there had been some friction between him and the CFTC over jurisdiction.
Chairman Dingell had the attitude that the two agencies should combine. Chairman Breeden believed that. I think Chairman Leavitt did, too. He just wasn't going to waste his time with it because it wasn't happening. I think that's a good stark difference between a guy who's been around for a while and a guy who hasn't. You know, pick your battles.
Right.
And Richard didn't pick his battles. He just wanted to fight them all. And so we pushed that. That didn't sit very well with Senator Graham, among others, mm-hmm. as well as the Agriculture Committee, both the House and the Senate, as well as the futures industry. And they pretty much handed him his head on that one. Mm-hmm. But conceptually, I think if you were starting the agencies from scratch, you would do that. That's the way it would start. But I think, you know, politically, this just a non-starter.
Yeah, it's easy to look back on that now from, you know, 20 years after and everything that's happened with derivatives and asset-backed securities and that sort of thing. But what was the perspective on it at the time? I mean, these were new innovations. I know that there was a lot of potential that was seen in them, but I think that it was also understood that these had to be sold to appropriately savvy, sophisticated.
And that was one of the arguments, a very successful argument from the future side, which is it was an institutional product at that time. It's only been recently retail. You know, and I think that underscored the difference between the two agencies. At the time, the CFTC did not have to have the investor protection focus they did today because of how the products were handled and sold. It was mostly a product for professionals and professional investors.
Okay.
Big guys who could take care of themselves. But that was an interesting fight. If Chairman Leavitt learned from how Chairman Breeden was treated in that space and did not wave the flag on that particular effort.
I know that Breeden was also involved in some of the post-fall of the Berlin Wall internationalization of
He was very interested in broadening the focus of the commission, not only domestically but internationally. Actually, Chairman Reuter kind of started that, in my judgment. That was before I got there. That was my impression. Chairman Breeden picked up on it, really launched it forward, and Chairman Leavitt built on that. So you had a pretty good history of the SEC recognizing that they were that they had an impact not just domestically but internationally, and they better pay attention to what's going on. And if you didn't, then you're going to have if nothing else, you're going to drop the ball from an enforcement perspective. Mm-hmm. So that was the first concern. If you want to protect investors, you could no longer just pay attention to what was going on in your country. You had folks in other countries doing things in your country that maybe they shouldn't be doing. And you know what? I'm so glad you brought that up, because I was not as active in that space as, say, Mary Shapiro was. Mm-hmm. But I think the SEC's work in the international space, especially from the late 80s to that decade, almost a decade, mm-hmm. was extraordinary. And I don't think they've received enough credit. The agencies received a great deal of criticism for not looking down the road. That's one area where they did, and successfully, mm-hmm. in my judgment.
One of the reasons why I wanted to ask about it is because I know that Breeden was involved with the reopening of the stock market in Budapest. And I noticed on your bio that you had been involved in Romania and Ukraine, maybe in a similar way.
When I left the SEC, you're barred from practicing for the agency for a while. I wasn't quite sure what I was going to do. I was, like anyone else, had been at the commission for 5 years. I was pretty weary. While I enjoyed, loved working in government when I did, I was kind of weary. You know, you have sort of after effects and a little bit of the aftertaste. You know, you kind of go through three phases. One, you're really glad you worked there, but sort of glad you're gone. And then you sort of go through, you look at it wistfully, and then you almost sort of forget about it. those is what I call is kind of the three phases. And so there were some opportunities to go over there and work. I'd never really traveled much. I couldn't really practice law, certainly couldn't practice before the SEC. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. So I had an opportunity to work for some contractors in some space. It wasn't particularly hard. Mm-hmm. I didn't get paid a lot, but it was one of the more enjoyable times in my life. I used to go to the Romania or to the Ukraine probably for a couple of weeks. More than that, probably for a week or so every other month.
Okay. Another issue was accounting. So there was the question of market value accounting, which was coming up. And then I was reading through some of your speeches, and you were talking about pooling versus purchase accounting and mergers, I think.
Chairman Breeden focused a lot in the accounting space, mm-hmm. especially a lot in the accounting enforcement space. Did a really good job. And Chairman Breeden built upon that. Chairman Leavitt built upon that, too. That was, in my judgment, under Chairman Breeden's tenure, that's sort of the beginning of the accounting enforcement context. Through that, I didn't know much about accounting. I got to work closely with the accounting staff. I think they're just fantastic. I still do to this day, although I don't know them as well personally. So they were kind enough and gracious enough to talk to me about certain issues. That was one of them that they did. And I had an opportunity to talk about it. And ultimately, it happened. They did change the standard, although after I left.
Okay. And before we get to the municipal securities focus, I wanted to ask just very generally about relations with Congress and then with the staff of the SEC as well.
My relations with the staff at the time, of course, I knew, mm-hmm. I thought the world of the staff that was there when I was there. I guess everybody does. Mm-hmm. And I thought so highly of them that when I was sworn in as a commissioner, I had Judge Sporkin swear me in, you know, because mm-hmm. I had someone with that SEC experience behind him. He was gracious enough to swear me in. That was one of my prouder moments. Very appreciative of him for doing that. And I wanted to do that because I thought it was a privilege to have someone that was on the SEC staff swear me in as a commissioner. So I think, now granted, there were a lot of fights and tussles and things of that nature and differences of opinion, but at least the 5 years when I was there under both chairmen, staff was held in very high regard.
Are there particular individuals you worked especially closely with?
Well, certainly. I mean, as I think legendary individuals. Linda Quinn, unfortunately, passed away several years ago in corporation finance. Elise Walter was deputy director. Everyone thinks they worked for the best staff, at the SEC. I believe I did. Bill McLucas was enforcement director. Rick Ketchum started off as market regulation director. Bill Hine was there at one point in time. Brandon Becker, Bob Colby, all those people were there. Barry Barbash was in investment management. Marianne Smythe was at the Division of Investment Management. It was just a terrific group of people. They all took a lot of time and trouble to teach me a lot of things, learned a great deal, and I was very proud of the work that they did.
Okay. And did you personally have much contact with Congress? Of course, you'd come from...
Not really. I tried to remove myself from that. Since I came from the staff, I sort of tried to stay away from that. I viewed that as a province of the chairman. You didn't, at that point in time, have the interaction. You didn't have the congressional interest that you did today, where they are much more focused on the SEC for various reasons. Almost micromanaging them. You did not have that. And that was, at least for me, if someone reached out to me, I talked to them, but I didn't initiate much.
Right.
Kind of left that to the chairman, both chairman Breeden and chairman Levitt.
And then, of course, Breeden had come from George Bush's
staff.
He'd come
from the White House, yes.
So I know a lot of the media talk at the time was that there might be a somewhat closer relationship between the SEC and the White House than was maybe ordinarily the case on account of that connection. Was that your impression? Or?
It may have been. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think that's true of any chairman, frankly. I think Chairman Breeden was close to the White House. I mean, it's a mixed bag. Some folks in the White House didn't like what he was doing. I think Chairman Levitt was close to the White House. And I think, by and large, his relations were probably better with the White House than Chairman Breeden's work. Sometimes when you come from a space, folks have mixed emotions for you. I know when I left as a Hill staffer, I'm sure there were some folks that didn't think as highly of me as others, and so that's one reason I try to remove myself from that environment.
Okay, so now let's go on to municipal security. So is it a foregone conclusion that you were going to make this? Sorry, Uncle. Was that a foregone conclusion that you are going to make that an area of focus since you'd had experience in it?
I had experience in it. It wasn't a foregone conclusion. It's like anything else. You sort of grow into it. I think it was just because it was a vacuum as much as anything else. I did take the initiative to speak on it a little bit. Nobody else did. And so usually when you're the only person to speak in an area, you do get a lot of attention. And so it sort of, the velocity increased when I was there. Velocity accelerated, but it was not something I thought a lot about. Sort of fell into it like anything else.
Mm-hmm. Rule 15C212 had already been put in place, but not the amendments of 1994. So, could you tell me a little bit about the perception of the state of disclosure? I know that you made that the focus.
Well, one of the individuals in Market Reg, Ed Pittman, was one of my counsels at first. He was one of the principal drafters of Rule 15C212. So I had a pretty good institutional knowledge in there, and it allowed me to build off of that. And it was very novel. I think very good. And frankly, it's about the only jurisdiction that the SEC has even to this day, which is unfortunate. It's all predicated on anti-fraud authority.
Mm-hmm. And so what did you view as being kind of the main things that ought to have been done at that time?
Well, I felt like my impression was the little bit of practice in there and a little bit I learned from it when I was working on the Hill and just talking to folks at the SEC and definitely market regulation staff at the time was of that view, that primary disclosure was okay to pretty good. Secondary market disclosure was very poor. And there certainly needed to be much more in terms of price transparency. And I think that's true. Well, I think the secondary market, I think those are still weaker areas today, although there's been vast improvements in 20 years.
Okay. I noticed in one of your speeches you were talking about basically a money market, tax-exempt money market funds, and the possibility for secondary disclosure there. It's not something that I've seen anywhere else in my study of the topic. I'm wondering if you have any recollections.
Not much, and I guess looking at it over time, you know, the focus is really on the taxable money market fund side mm-hmm. today. They're the ones that had, I think, concerns during the economic crisis, and I think most are of the view that tax-exempt money market funds didn't, relatively, they didn't have the same degree of problems. There weren't, you know, there were a couple of failures in the taxable area. That wasn't true in the tax-exempt area. So it was certainly an issue that I had some concerns with. It's odd, Will. I started speaking in the space, and I enjoyed it, and I couldn't see the SEC really doing a lot from a rulemaking standpoint because mm-hmm. we just didn't have much jurisdiction. We could bring a few enforcement cases, but even those were difficult. They had to be the right ones. Really about the only way you could implement much in the way of the improvements that you thought the marketplace needed was to use a bully pulpit, mm-hmm. and that's what I did. And sometimes I was more aggressive than others, and that was intentional, you know, to try to push the industry along. And by and large, I was pretty proud of that because my impression of the municipal securities industry today is not much different than it was then, although it's a lot more sophisticated and the space is much better from an investor protection standpoint than it was then, although according to Acting Chairman Walter's report, still got some steps that could probably be taken. And I think this is true for all the securities industry, but more so for the municipal securities industry. The professionals that practice in their area want to follow the rules. You know, they know that they have to deal with government issuers, on the one hand, that are interested in following the rules for the most part, except for a few bad apples. And on the investment side, their investors are conservative, risk-averse. They're not interested in a lot of funky stuff. I mean, you know, they want to get a yield. They want to know what they want to have a good idea of what the actual credit is and how much risk that they have and things of that nature. So the professionals are dictated by their customers, both the issuers and the investors, and they're very conservative groups. And as a result, the professionals in the securities industry want to be compliant with the rules. They want to adopt best practices. And while they grumble about a lot of things, you know, they want to follow what the SEC and the MSRB and FINRA ask them to do. And I think that's true throughout the securities industry, but much more so with the municipal industry. So it's very easy to go out and talk to those guys and say, this is what I think your practice should be. And sometimes they look at you and say, no, that's too far, you know, that's not right. We're not doing that. But, yeah, you make a good point here, and we're going to try to do some things in this space.
I mean, you make a good point in that the historical reputation of the industry is that it's very steady, very safe, and, of course,
and for the most part, yeah. Regulatory compliant.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, what was there ever a sense that reputation was in danger? What was the outside perception of this market, given its opacity?
There's been a few instances that I don't think they're very concerned about mm-hmm. the reputation. That is the most concern of them because they know because they'll lose the issuers and they'll lose the investors. And there've been some failures in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. Probably a few more recently due to the economic crisis, but still very, very little as far as defaults. Mm-hmm. You know, just a fraction of overall issuances. And, well, it's a very, very low single-digit mm-hmm. percent.
And at that time, of course, you're now pretty well removed from Whoops. The Whoops report had been in
yes.
87.
But that caused a stir.
Right.
And that even before
Absolutely.
I got to it. And that really led to... to some of the work that MarketRig did.
Right. And then, of course, then there was Orange County in 1994. Did that stir things up again? Had it settled down?
I was sort of toward the end of my term then. Yes, stirred things up very much so. And it got, and that really, that was in Chairman Leavitt's tenure.
Mm-hmm.
And that really, and he had Chairman Leavitt had a great deal of experience in the municipal securities.
I wanted to ask about this specifically.
Both from his dad and from his brokerage firm.
Mm-hmm.
And so when that happened, his interest in the space picked up considerably, mm-hmm. you know.
What was it like to have Leavitt come in with his... the weight of his authority behind this issue?
Well,
the
wealth of his experience, mm-hmm. the weight of his authority, a different management style, different point time of his career,
mm-hmm.
and a different approach. Substantively not different, but the personal style was far different,
mm-hmm.
you know, and much more careful, cautious, very active, you know. And when he was interested in an initiative, you know, he bored into it, and it was usually a pretty big initiative.
Mm-hmm. Of course, one of his focuses was pay-to-play, which we haven't talked about. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Again, that was Chairman Leavitt's initiative, and he was just stretching back from when he was in the business, you know, mm-hmm. Decades and decades ago, it left a bad taste in his mouth, and when some practices came to light when he was there. It was an area that he really went out on a limb, very aggressive, and pushed hard for and was successful with, and the SEC withstood litigation on that issue, as you know. He just felt like it was the practices, my impression, and again, I can't speak for Chairman Leavitt, he thought the practices were reprehensible.
Right. Did you personally have much contact with some of the various stakeholders in there, the MSRB, NABL, what was then the PSA?
Yes. Oh, yes, all the folks. Worked very closely, in particular, with the MSRB. Kit Taylor was head of the MSRB at the time. Worked very closely with the private sector. I spent a lot of time with NABL, but really even more time with the industry professionals. It was the Public Securities Association, and then it became the Bond Market Association. And I worked very closely with those, and I was very impressed with the broker-dealer side of the industry, and am to this day.
Okay. So what was – I know that there was some –
You know, there's one staff person that mm-hmm. I omitted. We're talking about all the great staff I worked with. Jim Doty was the general counsel, now head of the PCAOB. Learned a tremendous amount from him. Cy Lorne was a general counsel when I was there. Learned a great deal from him. Jim was there for a long period of time, and I'm disappointed that I did not mention him specifically. I should have.
Yeah, it's always easy to forget people.
They were unforgettable, but mm-hmm. My memory is not what it used to be.
Well, I think it happens often in oral history interviews. People often come back, why didn't I mention this person or that person? Can you tell me anything specific about the process of getting the 15C212 amendments through? I know that was fairly contentious.
It was not that contentious,
no?
Actually. Not really. Chairman Breeden was, the folks in Market Reg spent a lot of time with the chairman's staff. Some of the things I think they wanted some changes in, but in terms of the general overall scope of it, he was very supportive.
And people were satisfied at that time with that?
No, they weren't satisfied with it. They're not satisfied with it today, but that's just mm-hmm. the jurisdiction that you have. It's unfortunate that you have to predicate your rules on the backs of the broker-dealers. You know, you can't reach issuers, really. I think everyone's frustrated by it. Chairman Breeden, Chairman Leavitt, all the commissioners I work with, everyone, but that's just the lay of the land.
Okay. And then, of course, I just want to put note in here that you went from being a Democratic to a Republican member of the committee yourself when Shelby changed.
Yeah, when Shelby changed, I changed. It didn't really matter because there weren't five members of the commission, so mm-hmm. it didn't upset the balance. I was sort of toward the end of my tenure at that mm-hmm. point. At heart, I'd worked for Senator Shelby for most of my life, and so I just felt like that was the place for me to be. If it had been earlier in my career, I might not have been quite as outspoken about it, or if for whatever reason the SEC had been deadlocked politically, I may have had a different view. But it just so happened that the stars were aligned where that was a pretty easy path for me to follow.
Okay. And so let me ask, just to kind of cap off our
municipal securities. I'm not sure if any other commissioner has done that or not.
Hmm. I can't.
There's an asterisk by my name. I'm not sure there's another asterisk there.
I'd have to go through.
It's not something that I necessarily want to predicate my commission career on, but I do note that whenever I look at a list.
So let me ask about how much have you followed the municipal securities area since you've left the
commission? A good bit. I represent some folks in the space, and I always have. So I follow it closely. Now I'm really an advocate for folks, I represent people.
Okay. And what have been some of your impressions of the changes that have occurred over time? There's been the increasing availability of disclosure through electronic means.
I think the progress has just been amazing. And many of the things that I talked about when I was at the SEC weren't really practical. They couldn't be done then because the technology didn't exist. And again, you have to understand, you didn't have cell phones. You didn't have email. It was just beginning to start. We were still fighting over Edgar, Will. You know, Richard Breeden was pulling his hair out because of Edgar at the time, and it's such a marvelous success today. But it wasn't at the time. There's a lot of bumps and bruises. It was a tough period operationally, not for me, but for the chairman and the staff that were involved in operations and management. And today, you know, there's been so many wonderful technological improvements, and as the MSRB is taking advantage of those with Emma, I think it's just terrific. There's been a great deal of progress made, and I've been gone for 20 years basically, and there's been so much progress over the last 10. It's incredible, really positive in my judgment.
And then there are a lot of union-related products. I mean, of course, there was the rise and fall of the auction rate securities, bond insurance.
That was unfortunate. That was an eye-opener. Yes. And there was a lot of education, both in the private sector and at the SEC, in that area.
And in the wake of the financial crisis, of course, there's the Dodd-Frank legislation. What are your impressions of that and what it did with the
securities? I'm not a huge Dodd-Frank fan, to be candid about it. Some of that, I guess, is colored by the fact that I represent the folks, you know, and I'm a paid advocate. But, you know, my overall view, and I know the folks that worked on Dodd-Frank have a lot of respect for them, but if you look at Sarbanes-Oxley, as a result of the internet bubble burst and some of the corporate failings of Enron and things of that nature, Sarbanes-Oxley was a bipartisan bill. You know, it was put in place by Republican administration. It's worked very well. I think folks are proud of it. The jury's still out on Dodd-Frank. It was much bigger, much broader, maybe too broad in my judgment, covered too much space to probably... looking at it, and I hope this is offered as a constructive criticism, there wasn't enough, in my opinion, focus on what caused the crisis and what the solution should be. Instead, it was sort of a let's save the world kind of solution. And in some cases, I think they were solving a problem that didn't necessarily exist.
Are there any particular provisions that you would pick out as being particularly worth looking at?
I just think there's so many provisions that don't have much to do with the economic crisis. And I'll pick out some areas that I'm not involved in as an advocate because those are a little easier, and I'll avoid the others because I think my objectivity could be questioned. But I think things like conflict minerals, you know, things like, you know, the energy provisions. Why is the SEC involved in those? Those aren't really. You're using disclosure for social ends. I made some speeches about that in my career, and I think that's a mistake. I don't think those provisions should probably, if they should have existed at all in Dodd-Frank, I don't think they should have. They should have been directed to other agencies. So I'll pick on those since we're talking about the SEC here. I'm a big believer in shareholder democracy, like Chairman Breeden and Chairman Leavitt. Learned a lot from those individuals in that space. I don't know why Dodd-Frank was in that area, in that space. Maybe there's some connection with economic crisis. Again, I'm not representing people in that space, so easy for me to talk about. And then there's a lot of areas that I am involved that I have some concerns with, but I think where my objectivity could be questioned.
Okay. Of course, it's been a while since you practiced in Alabama, but I'm wondering if you had any particular insights on the Jefferson County situation.
I knew some of the individuals involved and knew some of them personally. It's very disturbing, unfortunate. You've seen it in other spaces too. You know, you saw it in Detroit. You've seen it in other cities. And it just made me sad.
Okay. So now, is there anything else coming back to your time at the SEC that we ought to cover that we haven't been through that's particularly important to you?
I'm sure there is, but I can't think of it.
All right. So let's talk then a little bit just in general about what your post-SEC career, you know, you mentioned the sort of three stages of...
Look at me. I worked for a consulting mm-hmm. area for a brief period of time. Then I was at a fairly large law firm for almost 10 years. And then I've got a fairly small consulting firm. I call it a consulting firm because we have lawyers and non-lawyers.
Okay.
And it sort of fluctuates where the demand is. Mm-hmm. You know, it's probably been in the past a little more SEC focused and more of a congressional focus today. And I've moved from... representing folks in Dodd-Frank to working on things such as GSE reform now because of the housing issue. So you move to where the demand is.
Right. And what would you say has characterized your practice? I mean, of course, you have your experience at the SEC and your previous experience.
It's just like my career in general, Will. I've been all over the place. Mm-hmm. It's been varied. I sort of moved to where I think there are opportunities or where there's a need to move. In terms of the SEC, if I find a vacuum where I think there's a need for an advocate or a representation, I'll go in that area, much like I did at the SEC.
And, of course, you have your experience at the SEC. You also have your experience in Congress. Have you been able to build off of that?
I've tried. I was able to put my kids through school. How about that?
Right. Okay. Well, I'm satisfied if you are, but if you have anything else you'd like to chat about.
Or vice versa.
Right.
Sometimes, like I said, you have to refresh my recollection. So,
We've gone through all the questions that I've laid out beforehand. So if we have anything else, we'll let you know. But that should do it for now.
Good.
Thanks very much.